Okay, we've come to Jeremiah chapter 12. It's a short chapter relative to some of the others, but it's packed and very rich. Jeremiah chapter 12. Righteous are you, O Lord, when I plead with you. Yet let me talk with you about your judgments. Why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are those happy who deal so treacherously? You have planted them. Yes, they have taken root. They grow. Yes, they bear fruit. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. But you, O Lord, know me. You have seen me. You have tested my heart toward you. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter, and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long will the land mourn, and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there, because they said, "He will not see our final end." If you have run with the footmen, and they have wearied you, how then can you contend with horses? And if in the land of peace in which you trusted they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? For even your brothers, the house of your father, even they have dealt treacherously with you. Yes, they have called a multitude after you. Do not believe them, even though they speak smooth words to you. I have forsaken my house. I have left my heritage. I have given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. My heritage is to me like a lion in the forest. It cries out against me. Therefore I have hated it. My heritage is to me like a speckled vulture. The vultures all around her, against her. Come, assemble all the beasts of the field. Bring them to devour. Many rulers have destroyed my vineyard. They have trodden my portion underfoot. They have made my pleasant portion a desolate wilderness. They have made it desolate. Desolate, it mourns to me. The whole land is made desolate because no one takes it to heart. The plunderers have come on all the desolate heights in the wilderness. For the sword of the Lord shall devour from one end of the land to the other end of the land. No flesh shall have peace. They have sown wheat, but reaped thorns. They have put themselves to pain, but do not profit. But be ashamed of your harvest, because of the fierce anger of the Lord. Thus says the Lord, against all my evil neighbors who touch the inheritance which I have caused my people Israel to inherit, behold, I will pluck them out of their land, and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. Then it shall be, after I have plucked them out, that I will return and have compassion on them, and bring them back, everyone to his heritage, and everyone to his land. And it shall be, if they will learn carefully the ways of my people, to swear by my name as the Lord lives, as they taught my people to swear by Baal, then they shall be established in the midst of my people. But if they do not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation, says the Lord. Now, the context of this chapter is important. It follows right on chapter 11. That's obvious, I guess. But in particular, the plot against Jeremiah's life, which was described in the last part of chapter 11, and the fact that God saw and revealed that plot against his life to Jeremiah and promised that he would punish the men. Verse 22, for example, of chapter 11, I will punish them. That's the context of that context of persecution in which Jeremiah brings forward the question in verse 1, why does the way of the wicked prosper? Now, that question occupies, I would argue, the entire chapter. The question of Jeremiah really goes in verses 1 through 4, and the Lord's response is in immediately in verses 5 and 6, but I think the whole chapter really deals with that question that Jeremiah asks, why do the wicked prosper? Now, that question, of course, is one that you can find elsewhere in the Bible and occurs, you might say, quite naturally to the righteous man, and I put up some references. Job certainly asked that question, the Psalms. Probably Psalm 73 is the most familiar example, where the psalmist sees the prosperity of the wicked and says it almost caused him to stumble when he saw how well they were doing. until he entered the sanctuary of the Lord and saw their end. And in the book of Habakkuk, Habakkuk was probably a contemporary of Jeremiah, but perhaps later than this time. Habakkuk saw the coming judgment under the Babylonians and asked the Lord, how can you use a wicked nation like the Babylonians to judge your people? So that question, of course, is one that occurs again and again, but you should realize that Jeremiah isn't asking it as kind of a philosopher. Let's sit back and ponder the question of evil in the abstract. Okay, that's not his purpose. This is a man who's suffering persecution of his townspeople, and as he's about to learn, and we saw last week, even the opposition of his immediate family, apparently. And he is a person who's very concerned with the fate of his people. So it's not abstract speculation. This is a heartfelt question, yet heartfelt in the question in the context of the covenant-keeping holy God. And so that's important to keep in mind. And Jeremiah acknowledges at the beginning that God is righteous. So the first half of the first verse or so is loaded with legal language. If you could rephrase it in legal terms, it would be something like this. I know, O Lord, that no one can file a case against you and have it sustained. But I would talk with you about some of your actions, as it were, your legal actions. That's the whole sense of it. And it's important to keep in mind that Jeremiah doesn't just start grumbling against God. What's the first thing he says? The first thing he says is, righteous are you, O Lord. That is basic to any desire to learn of God's ways must be an attitude of submission to God's providence. And that attitude of submission then conditions everything that Jeremiah says afterwards. And Matthew Henry, as he often does, has some helpful comments about this. He says, we must acknowledge it to him that the Lord is righteous, as the prophet here, even when we plead with him, as those that have no thoughts of contending, but of learning, being fully assured that he will be justified when he speaks. Then he refers to Psalm 51. So Jeremiah's attitude is not to complain against God, but to come to God, we're in Jeremiah chapter 12, but to come to God in with an attitude of willingness to listen, to learn what it is God's judgments are. He acknowledges that God must be in the right, and yet he would increase his understanding. And I would add, and Calvin makes this point, I think, pretty well, that this is not only for the value of Jeremiah, but for the people who would be hearing him. So imagine that you're here in this very corrupt time in the life of the nation, and you hear your prophet asking God why the wicked prosper. Now, what would that say to you? That would say, we're in trouble here. Jeremiah has already been commanded not to pray for the people, and this, I think, would be a warning to the people of a serious condition. Because Jeremiah isn't talking in the immediate context about the prosperity of the wicked nations, the way Habakkuk was, although we'll come back to that. In the immediate context, he's talking about the wickedness of the people, that is, the hypocrites who claim to be followers of the true God, but still were in opposition to him. So even this pleading with God has a purpose in Jeremiah's calling to warn the people of their perilous condition. Now, the description, why does the way of the wicked prosper, is developed a little bit in verse 2 in terms of the language of planting and bearing fruit. And that actually the planting and plucking and so forth will come up at the end of the chapter as well. It's a theme that ties the beginning and the end together. But this brings to mind, I guess, Psalm 1, you know, when God talks about planting the righteous like a tree and they bear fruit by the waters. And Jeremiah is saying, in effect, but wait a second, the wicked are like that. God is the one who has set them in their position. He acknowledges God's sovereignty. And yet it seems that they're bearing fruit. And they are hypocrites. The last part of verse 2 makes that plain. You are near in their mouth, but far from their mind. So that's, again, the language that Isaiah uses. Remember in Isaiah 29, they draw near to me with their heart, with their mouths, but their hearts are far from me. The verse which our Lord takes up in in the Gospels to describe the false worship of even the Pharisees at his time. So Jeremiah says, in essence, these people claim to be yours, but really they're just wicked, and they're prospering. And I, on the other hand, and then he turns to verses 3 and 4 to talk about his own condition and the condition, you might say, of the innocent sufferers. Jeremiah is not like those people. He is not a hypocrite. He says in verse 3, "You have tested my heart toward you. You have known me." And there's that strong word for knowing that we've seen used elsewhere and that Jeremiah likes to use. God has known him. God has set his love on him. God knows him thoroughly and intimately. And God is the one who searches the hearts and the minds, as we saw at the end of chapter 11, verse 20. And Jeremiah says, essentially, "You've done that for me. You know I'm not like these people." The implied question is, then why are they out to kill me? Okay, why are these things happening? That's the question that Jeremiah asks. Now, the answer to that question comes in the verses that follow, and I want to look at those verses, especially 5 and 6. But I'd like to pause just a second to look at verse 4, because it's an interesting question. It is formed as a question, but it's really followed then by a statement. How long will the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither? The beasts and birds are consumed for the wickedness of those who dwell there. Now, I mentioned before and noted as we went through the earlier parts of Jeremiah that he mentions the fact that the wickedness of the people has consequences not only for the people but for the entire land. And I don't just mean the dirt in the field, but the plants and the animals and so forth. This is a theme which is not isolated in Jeremiah, but I did note, okay, I got carried away as usual, but notice under verse 4 I put several references starting at 3:3, going all the way through chapter 50, verse 3, in Jeremiah of the references to the fact that the whole of creation is suffering, at least this local part of creation is suffering because of their wickedness. Now, the immediate context of that is probably the fact that God did not send rain when they needed it. And, of course, if there's no rain, then it's not just man who suffers. It's all of the crops and all of the beasts in the field. So the immediate context of the suffering that comes on them is because of God sending a particular judgment. And yet that's part of a larger theme. And then I put other references there, starting in Genesis 3:14 and going through the book of Romans. I actually could have extended it to the book of Revelation, I guess, as well. And that is the fact that man's sin has consequences for all of creation. Now, that's an important idea. After all, man was set as Lord over creation, and he was given charge to have dominion over the beasts of the earth. And what happened when he sinned? Well, it wasn't just that he lost his dominion and it had no effect on his subjects. It was that the land was cursed because of him. Right? Thorns and thistles it will bear because of you, for example, God says in the curse in Genesis 3. And that idea is played out again and again. The emphasis here is on the fact that man's wickedness has an effect not only on himself but on all of creation. And in the immediate context, it's there to call him to realize the seriousness of his sin. It's not an isolated thing. It is a destructive thing. One example of this, which came up earlier and is a very striking statement, is, keep your finger here or just listen, in Jeremiah 7:20. "Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, my anger and my fury will be poured out on this place, on man and on beast, on the trees of the field and on the fruit of the ground, and it will burn and not be quenched." And the commentator Fawcett adds, I think this helpful comment, "Why doth God send his fury on these? On account of man, for whom these were created, that the sad spectacle may strike terror into him." So that idea is a very important one, that man should realize that as given his exalted place over creation, the when God sends judgment, the judgment falls on all of creation as well. And if I could add just a secondary importance, I think it's helpful for our worldview. That is, we should realize that we live in a world where it's not only men that have fallen, but all of creation has fallen. And so when people look at the world and say, oh, this is the way things ought to be because it's the way they are, then they're missing the opening chapters of Genesis. This is not the way things were meant to be, in the sense that this is not the way God created them. Obviously, it's all part of God, the outworking of God's plan. But we live in a fallen world, and looking at the world around us, we must realize that all is not right, and look forward to the redemption that comes by Christ because of that. That's spelled out in Romans 8:20, where Paul talks about the whole creation groaning and looking forward to the redemption that will come at the return of Christ. And even as in part we can restore the dominion that in Christ that we were meant to have, we have to look forward to Christ undo the curse. And that's where, especially like in the book of Revelation, would be. So I mentioned that, and in part, I guess I've thought about this because of concern that those who want to look at the opening chapters of Genesis, especially chapter 1, and see not normal days, but ages instead, have to deal somehow with the fact that then there's, even if you deny evolution, a good bit of animal death that goes on before the fall of man. And this is no proof text that that didn't happen, but one does wonder if creation is groaning under the curse because of man's sin, why creation was groaning before the fall, if indeed that's a good description of the longer age view of creation. So that's just something that I think is important for us, as I said, as part of our worldview, to realize that we live in a fallen world. Not only fallen men, but all of creation suffers because of that. I'm not telling you to go hug a tree. It'd be okay if you want to, I guess. But any comments or questions in verses 1 through 4, including why do the wicked prosper? We're getting to the answer, but no. Okay. The answer that God gives in verses 5 and 6 is perhaps not the answer we would have expected, except that, of course, God doesn't usually give us the answer we expect. Now, you should understand again in the context, God has already said at the end of chapter 11 that he will judge those who seek his life. And so God has, in effect, answered Jeremiah's question by saying he will bring judgment. But what God says, in effect, in verses 5 and 6 is, if you think this is bad, then you should get yourself ready for worse, Jeremiah. If you have run with the footmen and they have wearied you, how then can you contend with horses? And probably the comparison is with the minor opposition he was receiving from the men of Anathoth, compared with what he was about to face from the men in Jerusalem, in the capital. Now, if you know, it's kind of hard to call people plotting to take your life minor, but if you'll just remember what's about to happen in Jeremiah, the king himself will be out to get him. I mean, the king will send his forces after him. And Jeremiah suffers horribly at the hands of the not just local authorities in Anathoth, but in the hands of the royal authorities in Jerusalem. That's probably the comparison that's implied here, although there's some variations in the interpretation of that. But then God says, gives another contrast. If in the land of peace in which you trusted they wearied you, then how will you do in the floodplain of the Jordan? And the floodplain of the Jordan, the New King James Version notes that it could be called a thicket. It's also in some translations referred to as the location of lions. Living by the Jordan wasn't, you know, the high-priced real estate area. It was a rough area, and there were also a lot of lions around there. So the idea is if you feel that you're in trouble in the nice, protected part of the land, how would you like to go out and live by where the lions live, Jeremiah? So again, it's a contrast between the relatively peaceful life he has now and what he can expect. Now, this may seem like a harsh thing for God to say, but I think each of us can relate to the fact that in our own experiences, it's very easy to get distracted in the midst of troubles from the lessons that we're supposed to be learning, and instead to just spend our time asking, why do the wicked prosper? God is saying, in effect, to Jeremiah, this is your opportunity to prepare for worse. Don't abuse it by abstract speculations. Don't be distracted by the fact that I am calling you to even greater things. That's the word. You could call it a reproof if you like, yet I think Jeremiah was very submissive in his attitude. That's the encouragement that comes from God, that he must prepare himself for more. And that is then, that more is spelled out in verse 6 in terms of showing Jeremiah what the situation was. As we said in chapter 11, the immediate description was that the men of his hometown of Anathoth were out to get him, and verse 6, it's revealed by the Lord that it's not just the men of his hometown, but his own family are out to kill him. And God gives him the reminder in verse 6 that he has a message to proclaim. Let nothing distract you from your message, Jeremiah. And as I've mentioned more than once, in the midst of Jeremiah's sufferings, he would surely have looked back to chapter 1, where the Lord called him and said, they're going to fight against you again and again, but I will make you a fortified city. And verse 6 is more or less a reminder that in the midst of that kind of opposition, Jeremiah has a message to proclaim. There's a striking figure. Yes, they have called a multitude after you in verse 6. The idea is like, you know, in the B movies when there's the guy on the run and the cops are after him and all the people are saying, get it, go get that guy. And they're calling the crowd and all running after him. That's the idea. Here's Jeremiah, and the whole town of Anathoth is running after him, trying to get him. They're sending a whole multitude after him. That's the picture. Any comments or questions down to verse 6? Right.
It seems to me God's reminding him that, I mean, I'm with you, Jeremiah.
Right.
You're in my hand. And all of us, I mean, we go through tough times, and if we start focusing on that tough thing that's surrounding me, we miss the opportunity to just rest back in God's hand. And yes, we got to go through it, but it's not going to hurt us.
Yeah,
it's not that bad thing. I mean, is the glass half full or half empty? It's, if you look at it as it's half empty and I'm missing something, then it's going to be hard because you're going to try and do it on your own. But with God, press on. It's like you're losing the battle, you're down to the last man, but God has said you're going to march victorious through the conquered land. So press on.
That's very helpful. That's right.
Yeah, I was just thinking on Brian's thought there of, well, you know, in one sense, you can hear Jeremiah saying bad things are coming to you guys, and they're prospering. So it's kind of like asking God, you know, seeing the wickedness of our nation and saying, why does our military prosper over in Afghanistan? Why are we not humiliated by these guys? We deserve to be humiliated.
Because God has a plan bigger than you and I imagine. I mean, we look at it and say, our country's done all this evil, but who knows what he's doing?
But we tend to question whether God really is going to cause them to suffer like we think they ought to in our timetable. And I think Jeremiah probably, you know, after you've told a bunch of people, hey, things are going to get really bad, hey, God, how can they prosper?
When's it going to happen? Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Well, and that, if we could then make the transition, that's more or less what God turns to in the verses that follow. See, even though there are only 17 verses here, I'm not going to cover every one in detail. It's too rich. I want to focus on the last part especially, but I'll make a few comments on this. In verses 7 through 13 especially, God talks about the judgment he will bring on the nation. So in effect, again, he's answering Jeremiah's question. This is maybe, you might say, part two of the answer. Part one is, Jeremiah, don't get focused on this. But part two is, yes, I will bring judgment. But when God says it, he says it with, if I could say it this way, a great deal of pathos. Did you notice that in verse 7? I've forsaken my house. I have left my heritage. I've given the dearly beloved of my soul into the hand of her enemies. God is saying, in effect, Jeremiah, you're talking about my covenant people. And yes, I will bring the destruction that the wicked deserve. But it is a very, very serious matter. The commentator Trapp, I thought, had a good way of summarizing that strong statement in verse 7. If I can find it in my notes, here we go. A man's house is dear to him. Right, he refers to his house first. Dearer his heritage or inheritance. Dearest his well-beloved wife. Jerusalem had been all this to God, but now for sin abandoned by him. And that's part of the feeling that this is my well-beloved, and yet, as Jeremiah says, under the inspiration of the Spirit, is God really speaking to Jeremiah in verse 8, therefore I have hated it, speaking of the rejection that must take place in time of his people. And that's a very sobering statement, and all of this, all these verses are filled with that attitude that God's people have turned on him. There's the picture of God going out to his well-beloved people, and now they're like a lion roaring at him. You know, what love is this they're showing to me in verse 8? My heritage is like a lion. I didn't put up again the references, but we saw earlier the similar idea to God's people being his heritage or in his inheritance. It's a very rich idea. And yet, because of their wickedness, God will bring destruction. And you may have noticed in verses 10 through 12, especially the repetition of the word desolate. And that reinforces, by the way, this idea that we were talking about of creation suffering. I have made a desolate wilderness out of my pleasant portion, and so on. The land is mourning. So that destruction that God will bring is an answer to Jeremiah's question. I think it should be understood that way, that God will bring this judgment. And there's an emphasis that it's not just a random event of history. Nor is it just the work of the Babylonians. It's God's work. And there's, again, a very striking aspect of that in verse 12. For the sword of the Lord shall devour. Right? The secular historian will say, well, it wasn't the sword of the Lord. It was the sword of the Babylonians. But God says, no, it's the sword of the Lord that devours. I am bringing this judgment on them. And that of course, then raises the question, well, wait. Isn't this a wicked nation that you're using to bring judgment? How can it be the sword of the Lord when it's the wicked Babylonians who, I suppose, at one level are far worse than the Israelites? They didn't have the revelation of God, so I think probably can't make a very good case that they're worse. But they were a nation given to gross idolatry, to violence, and to greed. And that then is the focus of the last portion. But I'll pause here because Brian wants to say something.
in doing that, God is going to humble that king, Nebuchadnezzar. I mean, to me, that's one of the most inspiring parts of the Bible, that Nebuchadnezzar, who arguably was ever the richest man in the world, I mean, he had it all. I mean, the world that was known was at his feet. And yet, God brought him to the point of humbling himself before him. If nothing else, I mean, God could have done it just for that one man. All of this. But, I mean, purposes, I think, are bigger. But, I mean, that's the way his economy is. For one man, he'll spend a nation.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and in a sense, that same idea, at least of the fact that there are broader purposes than just his own nation, comes in the last part. That's a good point. Any other comments down to verse 13? I know I still, it looks like I have a lot of time left, but 14 through 17 is packed, so I'd like to spend some time on it. Okay, so if the second part of the answer is, yes, I will bring judgment on my covenant people, then the last part is an amazing an even more amazing answer, part of the answer. Because God says in verse 14, first, He will bring, He will pluck them out of their land. That refers to those who have harmed His people. In particular, He calls them my evil neighbors. So, like, how do you like this neighborhood? You know, you got all these wicked people surrounding you. Well, that's the picture. And the reference, of course, would be to the surrounding nations who are mentioned again and again in the prophecies. Edom, Syria, Moab, Ammon, and Egypt on the other side. They, again and again, did what? Well, it says they touched the inheritance. There's a very strong aspect of this language. What is it they have to do to offend God in His care for His people? They don't have to ravage the land. All they have to do is touch it. And God says, that's too much. Don't mess with my inheritance. Don't mess with Texas. That doesn't ring good. Anyway. And that there are references, of course, to that. Also, I think I put up a reference down here on the board if you're following it. 2:3 in Jeremiah and also Zephaniah 2:8. Again and again, God warns the wicked, don't touch my people. You'll suffer the consequences. And so, you see, there's this amazing transition from the judgment which is due to His people to the mercy that God shows to His people. Because God says, you know, those people who have just touched my inheritance, anyone who has messed with my people, God says, I will pluck them out of their land. And this, of course, was true historically, that the Babylonians didn't just conquer Judah. They also conquered the surrounding nations and wrought great destruction on them. And God says, I will bring judgment on those people as well. Those who have brought any disfavor on my people, God says, I will bring judgment on them. And then He says, well, there's another plucking. And you got to watch your plucks here. But it says, I will pluck them out of their land. That's the first plucking. Okay, He's referring to the nations who were the wicked neighbors, like Edom and so forth. But then it says, and pluck out the house of Judah from among them. That's the promise that He will restore Judah from the exile. Okay, so the nations are going to be plucked in the sense that they're going to be judged by God, but when God's people are going to be plucked out in the sense that they will be brought back from the captivity to their promised land. And that that picture then is an amazing one. It gets more amazing here, but it is that God's faithfulness to His covenant extends so far that He will even bring back this wicked nation. These people are roaring at Him like a lion, and God says, I will be faithful and turn their hearts to Me again and bring them back to the promised land. It's amazing, but it gets even more amazing because what God says after that is, and I will even restore those wicked neighbors to seek Me. Now that, as they used to say in the 60s, blows your mind. Think about this. These are people who God has just said are touching My inheritance. These are people who have ravaged His own people. And, you know, you might expect, in answer to the question, why do the wicked prosper, God to say, I'm just going to wipe them all out, every one of them. You'll never hear from them again, Jeremiah. Don't worry about them. But what God says instead is, Jeremiah, I'm going to do something far greater than that. I'm going to turn them to seek Me. It's amazing. I mean, this is really... Jeremiah has some great passages, but this is, I think, one of the hidden gems in the book of Jeremiah. God says, I will bring them back, even those wicked nations, to Myself. Now, this ties in, if I could remind you, if you want to keep your finger there, or again, just listen, this ties into Jeremiah's original call. It says in Jeremiah 1:10, see, I have this day set you over the nations and over the kingdoms to root out and to pull down, to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. As we mentioned there, that the power of the word that came through Jeremiah is expressed there, but it isn't only to one nation that Jeremiah speaks, but to many nations. And it's not only to pluck out, as it were, but also to build. And that word, we'll come back to this, Lord willing, but that's the word used at the end of verse 16, established in the midst of My people, that is, to be built in the midst of My people. And Jeremiah has very specific prophecies. They're up there somewhere. Oh, yeah, okay. So as at the summary of this section, I put up chapters 47 through 49. That's a lot, a big cross-reference. But in the latter chapters of Jeremiah, he addresses these nations individually, one by one, and says, you know, you're wicked, you've done this and you've done that, and I'm going to bring destruction on you. And yet, even at the end of those, for example, I think it's toward the end of chapter 48, I didn't write it down specifically, God says, and yet I will restore you. Speaking to the heathen nation, I will restore you. And so that that will be part of what Jeremiah will be dealing with later. Yet I'd like to focus especially then as we, in the last minutes, on verses 16 and 17. God says that he will restore these nations. Now, I'd like to give the scriptural context of this, because Jeremiah isn't speaking in a vacuum. As I said last week, when Jeremiah was calling them back to covenant faithfulness, he wasn't winging it, you know. He was calling them back to the covenant that God had made with through Moses, and actually before that, as we'll see in just a second here. But Jeremiah isn't speaking in a vacuum here. And the fact that the Jews would be restored out of unfaithfulness is already talked about in Deuteronomy chapter 4, in the Book of the Covenant, in chapters 28 and 29. God promised them that even in the land of captivity, he would turn their hearts to himself and bring them back. He would circumcise their hearts. And that then is, of course, referred to, that is a promise of restoration from exile, is referred to again and again in Isaiah. I only put up some references here from subsequent references in Jeremiah, okay, because that's our favorite book of the year. Anyway, but Isaiah obviously has a lot about the restoration from exile. So Jeremiah is speaking here out of the basis of God's covenant promises when he says that I will restore the Jews. But how about the Gentiles? What's the context for that? Well, it goes back farther than the Mosaic covenant. And it goes back to Genesis 12. God says that I will make... let me not paraphrase it. Let me just read it. I've referred to it before. That's right. It's really something that's too... it was too easy probably for the Jews to forget, but we shouldn't just criticize the Jews all the time. It's too easy for us to forget that this was God's plan and purpose. Of course, it goes back even farther than that, as our pastor keeps referring to Genesis 3:15 and the seed of the woman in his preaching through Jeremiah and through Genesis. Genesis 12, now the Lord had said to Abraham, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So again, you know, Abraham might have stopped at the first part of verse 3. I will bless those who bless you and curse him who curses you. And Jeremiah could have said, okay, get him, Lord. Curse them, because they've been cursing us. But Jeremiah didn't stop there by God's grace. He received the promise of fulfillment of the last part of verse 3. And you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And that, of course, is developed. I put up some other references here, and it would be tempting for me to look at a bunch of them, but I won't. Psalm 87 is a tremendous statement of how God will call the nations as if they were born in Jerusalem. They are native sons brought back by God's grace. And there are lots of references in Isaiah and so on. This is to the ingathering of the nations. And God has some very interesting description of this. First, in verse 16, it must be that they will learn carefully the ways of my people. That is, the idea is, I think in the Hebrew it runs something like learning they must learn. So that's the way that in the Hebrew language you would express the need for diligence. And that means that conversion isn't a simple matter. Conversion of a nation, nor is conversion of an individual. It requires some work on the part of God, obviously, but also a diligent understanding, a diligent desire to understand what God's ways are. And even the description of what the ways are is interesting. It says, it shall be if they learn carefully the ways of my people. Now, Jeremiah might well have put in, well, we don't mean this particular people right now, because you don't want to follow what these guys are doing. But the intention is that these are the ways... God is looking at them in his in his gracious love, the ways of my people as I have taught them, he's saying in effect. And even that's a striking statement. Do you remember how chapter 10 started? I know it was a couple of weeks ago, but God said in the start of chapter 10, do not learn the way of the Gentiles. The word way refers to the religious practices, the doctrines. So God had told them, his own people, don't learn the way of the Gentiles. And now he's saying to the Gentiles, but learn the way of my people. Walk in my way. And that's then expressed in terms of the language of worship and of dedication to God. To swear by my name as the Lord lives. You swear by your God, right? I mean, the people in Edom wouldn't swear by the Lord because the Lord wasn't their God. They would swear by some other God. And the point is that in their conversion, they will faithfully worship God. They will acknowledge that he is the only Lord. And of course, the interesting thing is he says, as they taught my people to swear by Baal. You're going to have to become the student now and not the teacher. You'll have to stop teaching my people to swear by Baal and instead learn from my people to swear by the Lord. It's a remarkable thing, and Matthew Henry, again, has some interesting comments on this, just in terms of the greatness of God's grace and conversion. I think you can apply this on the individual level, and that's what he's getting at. He says, we must not despair of the conversion of the worst. No, not of those who have been instrumental to pervert and debauch others. Even they may be brought to repentance, and if they be, shall find mercy. And then he has two other points. Those whom we have been industrious to draw to that which is evil, when God opens their eyes and ours, we should be as industrious to follow in that which is good. It will be a holy revenge upon ourselves to become pupils to those in the way of duty, to whom we have been tutors in the ways of sin. And his third point is, the conversion of the deceived may prove a happy occasion of the conversion even of the deceivers. Thus, those who fall together into the ditch are sometimes plucked together out of it. And that's, I think you can see that true even in our own time. This God has worked mightily even in whole cults to turn them from deception to seek God in truth. And so we should never despair of people because we're measuring our own power to save, not God's power to save, when we despair of people. Instead, we should realize that God can even turn nations to himself. And then maybe just a couple of other points, and I'll be quiet. What's promised is very striking. They shall be established in the midst of my people. As I mentioned, the word established is the word to build. And no doubt this is the sort of language that Paul is drawing on in Ephesians and Peter in 1 Peter when they talk about how God will build a holy temple of the church, even using stones, as it were, of the Gentiles and not just stones of the Jews. We are all built together to be a holy temple. And it's a striking thing that God will take not only Jewish stones, as it were, but will build from the nations his name. And there's a further striking thing is it's in the midst of my people. Of course, in the Old Testament system, there was opportunity for the convert to come to God. But at least in Christ's time, you know, there was this outer court of the Gentiles, and you could only go so far, only come so far. And the striking aspect of this promise is they will be in the midst of my people, as if there will be no distinction anymore. There will not be Jew and Gentile, but that they will be built in the midst. And if you can put up with one more quotation, I thought Calvin had a very helpful comment on this. He says, nor is this to be applied to any particular place. That is, like he's saying that the Gentiles are all going to worship in a literal Jerusalem. I think that's probably what he has in mind, as some have frigidly explained it. But in the midst of my people is the same as though he had said, I will count those nations my people as a part of my church, according to what is said in the Psalm, and he has in mind Psalm 87, I think, that though the Tyrians and Sidonians and Egyptians and others who had been hostile nations were born here and there, yet they would boast that they were all born at Jerusalem when God owned them as members of his own people. Of course, what's so striking about this is that that's the privilege that we have, right? That's what we have in the gospel age. We have the benefit of God, as it were, turning the hearts of the nations to himself. The final comment I would make is just on the last verse, and that is that God is not promising here a wholesale conversion, or you might say that it will be without any exceptions. Because he adds in verse 17, if they do not obey, I will utterly pluck up and destroy that nation. And that is, the work that God is referring to is a work which involves repentance and obedience to God. Chapter 60, verse 2, is a parallel passage in many ways to this. I put it up, I think, in the list. And there's a verse there that says something very similar. For the nation and kingdom which will not serve you shall perish, and those nations will be utterly ruined. That is, God will bring destruction on those who refuse to serve him. And sadly enough, this applies even to the Jews and the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, because they refused the Messiah. They suffered the hand of judgment that God brought on them. So then, just to try to summarize, as we've looked at various points, the context is the question that Jeremiah asks: why do the wicked prosper? God immediately addresses Jeremiah's own personal situation and says, you have a calling, stick to it, don't be distracted, and be encouraged that I am with you still. And then he turns to say he will bring judgment on his covenant people, and yet, amazingly enough, in the last part he says, I will bring the restoration. If I could just add the kind of to harp on the messianic note in conclusion, when God says that he abandoned his well-beloved, bringing judgment on them, you might see that as only a picture of the abandonment of Christ, who suffered in the stead of his people, who God rejected in a sense, that is pouring his wrath on them. And it's only because Christ went through that, only because God turned his back, as it were, on his well-beloved in putting the sins of his people on him, that we have the promises at the end of the chapter. That's the only reason why any nation can be gathered to serve God. It's because of the work of Christ. Okay, so look at that. See, I even filled out the whole time, a short chapter. Any comments or questions? No? I think it's a really cool chapter. To speak again in 60s terms. So. Or would they use the word groovy? That one didn't last very long. No, seriously, it's a wonderful answer to Jeremiah's question, far beyond, I think, what Jeremiah might have expected as a mere man, apart from God's revelation. Okay, well, let's close in prayer.